And Mark Pesce is here with us right now with news from the world of tech. And you've found us more weird and wonderful and slightly creepy things. As always, Mark, welcome.
Good morning.
Let's begin with the San Francisco police, or actually what the city council's done to enable the police to do what?
So, as you know, we have an explosion now on these connected surveillance cameras. We have talked about the Ring camera and how Amazon has been giving that data to police, whether or not the owners have permitted it. Well, it seems that the San Francisco Council has basically said that if homeowners opt in, police will have the right to use the streaming footage, the live streaming footage from their security cameras. There are specific safeguards around it, so it has to be if there's a misdemeanor that they think is taking place or a property crime. But the broader exception, which is really causing a lot of people to be disturbed, is that if there's some sort of public protest, effectively police have the right to use every surveillance device that's installed on a private home. So that might be every camera that's pointed in, it might be every doorbell that's pointed outward, to be able to keep an eye on that public protest without any indication that there have been any laws being broken.
Eek. Two quite different things. Let's start with the first, which is if you've got had a break-in at your house or maybe at your neighbor's house, who needs to opt in order to allow the police to access this?
So anyone who has a camera connected will need to opt in to have the camera accessed. And I think it's a little vague now, but
really
whether
they're... It's not really opt-in, is it, Mark?
Well,
that's not what I think of as opt-in. That's either have the camera or don't have the camera.
I feel like you're probably right. In terms of opting in, once you have the camera, it's clear that you're opting in. We already know that Amazon was giving footage to police without the owner's consent. In this case, it's explicitly spelled out that the owner has to provide consent. Whether that will be observed in practice is always going to be the interesting question. And whether we ever find out that it was not observed is also another question.
We're not talking about stills here either, are we? They can come and have a good old look in real time.
No, this is being basically able to put your eye up to someone's peephole and look out through it.
And also, if your cameras are pointing, I don't know, along the side of the house or in the backyard, all of that, right?
This is the point. You know, people are like, well, if you're looking inside the house, and of course, that's one set of questions. Most of these are looking out. And so this now raises a whole bunch of issues about public space being policed and surveyed in a very different way. And a lot of people in San Francisco, where because there has been such an influx of tech billionaires, so many people got rich off of Facebook and Twitter and Google and on and on and on, that it is now very, very segregated by wealth. So there's very rich people and basically very poor people, and medium income people can't afford to live in San Francisco anymore. And so people are pointing out that the public spaces are primarily filled up with very low income people who will now be over-policed because they are over-surveilled.
Does this also work for those wealthy people when someone burgles their house, frankly, or is in the backyard making off something? Would that be another context that the police could use this or not?
It clearly is one of those contexts. There is a billionaire who made his money in crypto, who spent $4 million since 2012 installing 1,000 security cameras around San Francisco just to keep the area better surveyed. So you can see how this is really reinforcing a kind of class distinction, that rich people live in places where they make sure there aren't cameras that can be tapped into so they can do whatever they want to do, and poor people are living in places where they're constantly under observation.
What it sounds like is the gated community is being expanded to most of San Francisco.
Yes, and that the gated community doesn't have any physical gate, but it clearly has a gate of surveillance.
On the question of the public protests, this is another whole level again.
Yeah.
And look, remember, the camera might catch your neighbour's property. I don't know whether they have to opt in or opt out. And of course, it will capture, as you say, potentially capture public space, even if it's just a fleeting image, it will place someone in a particular place or time, or perhaps catch something that happens. So just to elaborate there, are there any laws applying to the public right to protest that come up against this new surveillance?
I don't think so. I think we're talking about stuff that is so new that people haven't really thought through the implications. But, you know, you talk about catching a fleeting image. If it's a doorbell is pointed out to the street. And if a protest is going by on the street, a doorbell should be able to capture enough footage that you could then do facial recognition on everyone who was walking by in the protest and basically get a really good list of everyone who was involved. And if you have enough cameras doing this, it's really easy to get that full list. And so here we see the intersection of not just surveillance, but also now the AI technologies that are in play to be able to do these kinds of things.
So just roll me back. Are we talking about that particular doorbell that we've talked about previously?
Yes.
That's creepy. And does that doorbell give you a screenshot effectively right across a street, for example?
Yeah, I mean, a Ring doorbell, which is what we've talked about, basically gives you, with a relatively fisheye view, but it gives you a view out, not just who's directly in front of the doorbell, but if there's no one blocking that view, it will give you a view out into the street. And, of course, there are also Ring cameras, not just Ring doorbells, which can look at the door, or can look at the garage, or it can look out into the neighborhood. And people have all of these. They're all connected. They're all constantly feeding that stream of data into, well, whether it's Amazon servers or whether it's the local police department.
So when we talk about AI, again, and facial recognition, again, are there any protections in San Francisco over the use of facial ID? You know, generally there's a principle, and we've talked about it beginning to be introduced to combat shoplifting in stores, etc. But are there any laws that govern who can use that and when, or is all this lining up to the kind of picture you're painting us, which is that police could have a real-time, very comprehensive, able to individually identify who was in a protest?
Funny you should ask. Yesterday, the White House actually introduced something they're calling the AI Bill of Rights, because they also see all of this happening. And so now what they're trying to do is develop a framework which will allow people to understand what are ethical uses of artificial intelligence, what constitute unethical or privacy infringing uses. There are some laws on the books in California, maybe about using facial recognition in this way, but really there's probably more than one way. We know that you can recognize someone from their gait pretty much as reliably as you can recognize them from their face, because we all walk quite differently from one another. So you really have to have a more blanket protection in there rather than just something that's going to work with a specific technique. And I think that's what this AI Bill of Rights, which, whether it becomes law, whether it becomes guidelines and perhaps regulation, we're going to see. But it's clear that at least the United States is now starting to make its first attempts in this direction.
All right. Interesting stuff. On the other hand, Google is watching you in a good way or a bad way.
You know, and here's the thing, because most of the time I think we think Google is probably watching us in, well, they're not going to tell us whether it's a good or bad way. But now Google has said, look, so much information is getting released online about people. People are being doxxed or there is a break-in. You've probably heard about the enormous Optus data breach that we had in Australia last week. I am one of the 9.8 million people affected in that data breach. So there are bits of my personal data that could start floating up online. And Google has said that from the beginning of next year, they will keep an eye out for links to my personal data, and they will offer me the opportunity of killing that link. They can't erase the information from the web. They can make it harder to find.
Now, won't that information be turning up on the dark web? And if so, what is the link between Google's omnipresence and the dark web?
So the dark web, by nature of being dark, means it isn't or cannot easily be indexed. So all of Google's techniques that allow people to find things don't work the same way on the dark web. On the other hand, you can't search the dark web. So someone can't just type Mark Pesce into the dark web and then come up with the particulars. You may still have a huge data trove that you could then download and search through yourself. And that, of course, that is what will happen in the dark web environment. But making it less accessible, basically putting it outside the range of Google, means that in 99% of the cases, people will not be able to find it.
So where will your stuff potentially turn up? And my condolences along with you and millions of other Australians.
9.8 million others, yes.
But where potentially will it turn up? Just as a cautionary tale for, you know, because this theft can happen any number to any number of us in various ways. So where could it tune up that Google might be able to assist with?
So it's conceivable that if someone took some of this data and said, here's Mark Pesce and here's his particulars, right? Or it's just on a big list that was on a web page that Google read that was publicly available, that's when it would be something that they would be able to highlight and remove. Or if someone had posted on Twitter, here's Mark Pesce particulars if you want to dox him or if you want to, you know, do an identity theft with him, whatever it might be, they would also be able to detect that. So it would have to be something that would show up on the public web. That's something that Google can see. And so that could be, you know, a Twitter post, it could be a Facebook feed, it could be on Discord, it could be on Reddit, it could be on any of the places, even in a comments thread, say on stuff.co.nz or Fairfax or whatever it might be. All of that is publicly searchable. All of that would be visible to Google.
That's a lot of search power, isn't it?
Google is searching, yeah. Reads the entire web,
I know.
Sort of every 2 or 3 days, the entire thing. So, yes.
It is mind-boggling, the search power involved in that. You know, even for 9 million individuals, let alone for everything else, it's tracking. And speaking of tracking, you mentioned they might be able to break a link but not remove the information. Is this because the information will be cached? There'll be multiple versions of it. Is it virtually impossible to remove it?
It's that Google doesn't control the web server that is holding that information. All they can do is control their own index that allows that information to be searchable. All right. So if someone posts it up on their own website or on their own comment thread, but what, of course, I can do is once Google has told me this information is up there, if it's on a comment thread on a public website, I can then go and say, you need to remove this information. This is private information to me. So I do then gain agency, which is better than nothing.
Better than nothing might be all we've got for a while on a lot of this stuff. Now, cyborgs and cockroaches both have their own history and probably provoke their own responses in people. What happens when you put them together, and why would you?
I'd like to say because you can, but actually the intention is really quite noble. So this is done by some Japanese researchers who miniaturized enough electronics and stuck them on the back of a cockroach. I think probably literally glued it so that the cockroach can be given tiny electric jolts to send it right or left, and it can be controlled via Bluetooth. Now, why would you do this to a cockroach? Well, particularly if you're in Japan or actually in New Zealand where you get a lot of earthquakes and buildings collapse, you would want to send cockroaches into the building to go search for people because they will be able to get places that people and anything else simply cannot. And so the thought is that as we refine this technology, it will be able to basically give us cyborg cockroaches to use to be able to find people when they are in emergency situations.
And so that data presumably has some kind of GPS on it, and the poor little cockroach, no one's asked it, but anyway, it's being turned left and right. We know it'll survive the apocalypse, nothing else will, but the cockroach will. So it'll be turning left and right until it locates. How does it know what it's trying to locate? How would it know what it's looking
for?
It's
feeding a data stream because it's got enough sensors on it. It is feeding that data stream back to the operator.
A visual data stream.
I think probably it's a little bit more sort of radar-ish than visual because it's going to be dark in there, so a camera doesn't buy you a lot.
So maybe heat-seeking kind of data or something.
Heat-seeking and probably radar. Oh, there's a void in there. There could be someone in there. You can have a speaker. Do you hear a voice? All of that stuff is still really useful when you're searching for people who might be trapped in a structure. The one design thing is that the battery will last for about 2 hours. They've designed it to be solar chargeable, but of course, as we know, cockroaches don't like sunlight. So keeping the device charged right now is the hard thing. So we might release a fleet of cyborg cockroaches, but if they don't find it in 2 hours, well, then they're just going to be free to live their cockroach lives.
Yeah, with a pack stuck on their back, quite literally.
Yes.
This is going to be the next dystopian horror. I can tell the cockroaches push back. I shouldn't be so flippant because if it works, it could be an amazing tool in the toolbox, I guess. So where are they at? I mean, are they actually doing kind of experiments or what?
Yes. They've got the prototype up and running. There is no question that it works and that they've managed to miniaturize everything. They're still working on trying to make it run for longer, use lower power Bluetooth, all of that. But there's no question that we can now have a cyborg cockroach.
Now, Elon Musk, it's becoming the soap opera of the century,
Yes.
And why? Like, we're having the twists and turns. We had him try to pull out of the deal. He put up his reasons for trying to pull out of it, which were people were a little bit dubious about. Then there was the court case. Now the deal might be back on. Can you please take us inside the mind, to the best you can, of Elon Musk?
So on today or tomorrow U.S. time, he would have had to sit for a deposition in which basically all of his thinking and all of his motivations were being revealed. And it was pretty clear that he was going to lose the court case and he needed to avoid a public deposition. And so apparently he decided to settle by buying Twitter. Now, Twitter's board has basically put the lawsuit on hold because the agreement is theoretically going forward. But at any point, that lawsuit can resume if Elon gets cold feet again. So what this is indicating is that he never really had a strong case to back away from the deal in the beginning. And again, he didn't, because he basically said he was going to buy Twitter without regard to any terms, what state of the business, whatever, basically buying it as is. And then he said, oh, but there are all these reasons. And they're like, well, you said you're going to buy it as is, and we're going to go to court to force you to buy it. So he filed a document with the SEC on Tuesday, U.S. time, saying, yes, I'm going to buy it at the agreed price.
$44 billion, which represents what of his net wealth?
So when he made the offer, he was worth almost $300 billion U.S., and now he's worth about $240 billion. So he's actually lost more than an entire Twitter in his personal wealth since he made the offer. But he's still, you know, $240 billion. That's you know, not chump change.
So do we think this is buying time again, or do we think it's, no, I'm going to have to buy this, and if I am going to have to buy this, remind us of what his plans are for Twitter?
Okay, so I think if I were Twitter's board, I would be thinking about Charlie Brown and the football and Lucy, right? Because you just don't want that football to get yanked away again. So I think they're probably waiting to get cash on the table. Hopefully that all has to happen very quickly or the lawsuit goes forward. If he does buy it, he has this vision that he's been tweeting about without being very specific for the X app, the Everything app. Now, let's step back a minute. There's the WeChat app. Probably a lot of people in New Zealand use the WeChat app, very popular in China. It's designed to be not just a messaging app, but it has all of these other things that plug into it, all these businesses, all these opportunities. You can buy, sell, trade, all these things, bank, all through the WeChat app. Twitter made a decision back in 2012 that it wasn't going to play nicely with other businesses. There were a whole bunch of other businesses who wanted to work with Twitter in all sorts of ways. Twitter has basically just done its own thing, made money off of advertising, isn't really open to other business partnerships. It looks like Elon's going to revisit that decision and turn Twitter not just into this messaging app, but with all of these other interesting commercial opportunities that will tie in and work through it and become, as he calls it, the X app or the Everything app.
What's its trajectory been? It's sort of become characterized as the place where everybody is very angry all the time. And look, of course, everyone can point out the hilarious memes, and there are times when it just comes into its own. We've all been watching the poor old Liz Truss, whatever her name is, Trustee or whatever, who's accidentally become the British Prime Minister. And, you know, there's lots of laughs attached to that. But it's also perceived as being a place of very, of not always representing the best of ourselves, our little angry kind of red rage response. Is it working still as a business model? Is it in decline as a business model? Is it up for a renewal in a different direction?
It has never truly been an entirely profitable business in its current model, which is basically advertising based. And I think it's sort of trudged along. Yes, it may be worth $44 billion to Elon Musk, but it's never really been that kind of success that people would have thought, like a Facebook, which, you know, occasionally reaches nearly $1 trillion, or a Google or something like that. It's never had that kind of breakout success. And so there's a big question about whether it's ever really been thought of as an economic entity or really just as the 21st century's communication medium of choice for politicians and for journalists and for people who are interested in current affairs or people who simply like to shout a lot.
Sometimes the two are related. Thanks, Mark.
Yes.
Mark Pesci.
Thank you.
Technology correspondent.